What will work look like in a decade? How much white collar work can AI do, and how will people engage and interact with AI? We're chatting with Slater Viktorov, who's the founder and CTO of Indico, which does enterprise AI. Welcome, Slater. What do you spend your days doing?
So I'm the CTO at Indico, and as you said, we focus primarily on, you know, this enterprise AI space. You know, Indico is the unstructured data company. So when we talk about the things that I'm really doing on the day-to-day, thinking about document automation, right? Thinking about video use cases, text, image, you know, stuff along those lines. You know, that's a lot of what I'm doing day to day. You know, there's a lot of more specific things down further in the weeds on the research. But, you know, if we start talking about that, you know, I'll be going off for hours.
And we wouldn't want that. Let's talk about AI assistance for our daily jobs. I mean, all of us, whether we realize it or not, we have AI assistance right now. I do a web search because I'm doing research, and guess what? AI is involved. I need to add 10 numbers, and I quickly, you know, pull up my phone and invoke Siri or Alexa or Google or whatever. I'm using some level of AI. What else is happening today?
So, you know, I think the first thing, obviously, that you've said is that there's a huge proliferation of AI within working systems, right? And I think that to a certain extent, right, there are even certain features that we've just started assuming are kind of usability features. When we talk about, you know, basic recommendations, when we talk about, you know, voice notes, stuff along those lines, right? And they're little intelligent kind of features, right? But the sum total of them actually builds up very, very quickly. You know, Google obviously being a really obvious example of something that powers, you know, the backbone of productivity for a huge number of knowledge workers today. And, you know, also they're kind of the most sophisticated AI engine out there. You know, I think one of the things that's very interesting, if we talk maybe specifically about automation for a second, right? Because sort of the interface of AI and work, it's huge. The way that I see it, there's sort of two competing thought processes out there, right, in terms of how is AI going to impact work, how do we work together, and what does that interface look like? And I think one mode is what I would call the Android mode of thinking, which is, you know, an AI worker is going to come in and sit next to me, and it does some portion of a work of a human worker, something along those lines, right? And I think that stands in pretty stark opposition to what I personally prefer, which is the bionic arm notion of AI, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the idea that, you know, this is fundamentally a tool like any other, right? And, you know, you can lift 10 times as much, right? You can do your work 10 times better, but it's still fundamentally you doing the work. And you know, again, I think that I think that folks in both camps have their own, you know, views, right? I think we've all got our own biases that we bring to the table. But personally, I'm very much in that bionic arm camp. You know, I'm a you know, peanut butter and jelly better together kind of person.
And actually, that might be a great way to put it, with the peanut butter and the jelly, because both might be true.
You know, it's totally, yeah, totally fair. You know, time will tell, right?
Absolutely. It's interesting, actually. I mean, you mentioned Google, and their auto-suggest is getting scary good. I mean, you know, sometimes I write an article and I could just tab, tab, tab.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And actually, I don't know if I mentioned this, but actually my original co-founder at Indico, Alec Radford, you know, he's the lead author of GPT, which is sort of one of the, you know, really key models, but behind that stuff, right?
Just a little. Hey, GPT-3 is pretty impressive, almost scary good.
There was a really cool article that actually came out today from the Allen Institute that's, actually, GPT-3 is so good that untrained human reviewers cannot tell the difference between GPT-3 text and human text better than random chance. It came out at exactly random chance. They have no idea.
I can't tell you how scary that is in an era in a post-fact era.
that is the thing, right? You know, I think that that's the, you know, on the one hand, it's really fun, right? I think there's obviously a lot of really positive implications of these kinds of technologies, but I mean, that risk is there, right? It's very much there, and it's not something we've got a great answer to, in my estimation.
Let's look into the crystal ball a little bit and maybe look out 5-10 years. How do you see knowledge work happening with an AI, with AI assistance? Let me put it that way. And that's assistance with a CE at the end, not a TS. It could be both.
Sure.
How do you see it working?
So, you know, it's a good question, and I'll first, you know, give my politician non-answer, which is that, you know, it's going to look different in every industry.
Yes.
Right? But more than that, right, I think that the most important thing, especially for folks that aren't necessarily directly in those white collar jobs today, is to understand how little of a typical knowledge worker's job today is actual knowledge work. Right. And, you know, I think that that's true in the vast majority of places. Right. It doesn't matter if you are a lawyer, right, or an accountant or a software engineer or a data scientist. Right. So much of what you're doing, it is the paper processes on either side. Right. You know, it is a lot of this stuff that is in some way, shape or form automatable. Right. Obviously, a lot of that in my estimation, right, has to do with unstructured data. Not all of it. Right. But there's a lot of opportunity to really, I think, free people up to do more of that knowledge work. I think that one of the other things that's going to become a lot more common, and we've already started to see this, right, is expertise around programming and AI. And I don't mean that everyone has to be a researcher. I don't mean that everyone has to be a software developer. Right. But I'm talking, you know, Excel scripts level of coding. Right. Yep. I'm talking big, fuzzy animal pictures of AI.
Low code, no code.
Yeah. You know, I think having that level of understanding, I think it's going to stop being an option. Or plus, I think it's going to start being very, very common and something that we feel is actually really critical to do our jobs, even if, you know, today it feels like the furthest thing in the world from AI.
It's a really interesting thing to think about. And I've got to double check. I confess I haven't checked. And maybe you know. It'd be very interesting to see if somebody's done a hardcore study of what percentage of a knowledge worker's day is actual value add work and what percentage is finding stuff, sending stuff, extracting stuff, transforming stuff, all that other things that could typically be automated, you think?
You know, so they've done this in really localized specific areas, right? It's part of why I use the example of a data scientist is, you know, there's pretty good studies there and something like 80% of a data scientist's day is this automatable munging, right? In some way, shape, or form. But I think actually the broader answer is that we don't know, right? Everyone agrees the number is very, very high. Right. And everyone's kind of exhausted by it. But one of the other things that has kind of become clear to me on the other side is that these are, you know, we talk about black boxes in AI. We don't talk as much about black boxes in human processes, which is actually kind of what these things are. Right. They're highly non-transparent where, you know, take a loan approval process. You know, we all want to believe this is some, you know, incredibly well-oiled machine. It's completely objective. Right. And now, obviously, nothing could be further from the truth. And, you know, when you look inside of these organizations, what's happening in sort of truth, right, in reality, is that they see, okay, loan application packet 552 showed up on Bob's desk. Yes. Bob says it's good to go, right? And that's all of the information that they've really got.
Yeah, yeah. I do look forward to the day when I have a personal AI assistant, but I don't feel like that's the way things are going. The way things are going is Apple has an AI assistant, Amazon has one, Google has one, Samsung kind of has one, various different cloud tools that I might use and other tools that I might use have AI components within them, but I don't have Ask Jeeves. You know, I don't have Jarvis. Do you see Jarvis coming in the future?
No. Not at all.
That is sad news.
I disagree. I think that because I think the reason why not is maybe different than what you're expecting, because it's not a technical limitation. You know, I think the problem, right, is that what people have internalized in a lot of cases as AI, I think it's more magic than technology. Yes. Right. Because when you look at Jarvis, right, and you think about the things that's really exciting about what Jarvis does, right, it's nothing to do with intelligence or reasoning or anything like that. It's the fact that he can magically read Tony Stark's mind, right, that he can do novel research, right, and create novel materials at the drop of a hat. Right. And you know, I think that in a lot of our conceptions of AI, right, if you kind of peel back the onion a couple of layers, you have those similar sort of impacts. And so I absolutely get the desire. Right. I mean, who doesn't want, you know, an omnipotent genie that can solve all knowledge problems, right?
Doesn't even need to be omnipotent, just, you know, somewhat powerful.
You know, I think that slope is a lot slipperier than people recognize, right? So that's my view, right? It's not that I think that there's a fundamental technical limitation. It's that I think that And it goes back to this bionic arm analogy, right? I think that, you know, really purpose-built tools that are very, very effective, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think we're going to see a lot of those, even more so than we've seen them already, right?
So I understand that it's easier to have verticalized AI. Do you think that's the future, at least the near term?
I'm not even saying verticalized, right? And I actually don't believe in that generically. I'm making a point about it being purpose driven, right? Because again, you know, what I'll always say is that we get the pitch from our customers all the time. We want you to scrape the internet and do magic, right? That's what I'll always say. And again, I think people have to understand that AI is fundamentally, you know, it is a mirror, right? You know, we are training it to do a particular task, and then it's learning to repeat that task again and again and again very quickly, right? There's no magic, right? There's no like new novel thought processes that are happening, right? That's just not what AI is, right? Mm-hmm. AI is, in my view, best conceptualized a mirror. And you know, it's not a perfect mirror. It's a mirror that's got, you know, 100 different pockmarks on it. So for whatever you show it, and you know, show it the world in terms of data, right? It's going to take parts, and it's going to ignore bits, and it's going to amplify other bits, right? And come up with these tweaks and whatnot. But, you know, it's not a thinking thing, right? It is not a human. And again, that's not a technical limitation. It's just that's just never been what AI is. And in fact, I'd argue that it's something that only exists as a sci-fi concept, right? And if we even kind of draw it to its logical extension, even if you just, this is kind of what I think every book Isaac Asimov has ever written is about, is the concept of AI is actually not well reified, and there's no way we can put it together such that it makes sense or even leads to a consistent world, right?
Oh, this is very sad. I do hope for some level of general AI at some point.
Do have general AI. Right. But general AI is not a magic genie. Right. That's the point that I'm making. Mm-hmm. I mean, GPT-3, right. That is general AI. It's completely not purpose driven, you know, whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't care whether this is a law task, right. Or sentiment analysis or marketing or medicine. It can do it all. Right. So we kind of solved that from the general idea of, you know, this is generic AI. Again, the problem is that we have to be able to say what we want.
Is that really general AI? Because it's general AI in a certain field, right? I mean, I can't ask GPT-3 to design a house for me, can I?
I mean, you probably could in specific areas, yeah. I mean, certainly there's plenty of techniques out there that you could use to help you generate houses, you know, even older techniques than GPT-3.
Wow.
And that actually, I would say that's a great example. Right, is that if you decide you want an AI that will help you, you know, to generate houses, yeah, you know, that's doable. Like that is a thing that you can do, right?
Yep.
But it's distinct from, you know, a magic genie that can do random thing I think of, right?
Let's talk about that a little bit then, because we do see that AI is invading pretty much every occupation, pretty much every area, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so 100%. For instance, today, what, 0.1% of people can afford to hire an architect and design a home that they would love to be in. But we start seeing tools that are coming out right now that you can, you know, go through a bit of a process and something can be designed. Accountants, there's no reason why we can't have AI accountants. There are some on the market right now, I believe. Lawyers, we've seen some efforts to make lawyers that are AI lawyers. And nobody's going to say that, you know, you want an AI lawyer representing you in an actual court case. But there are uses for them, correct?
Well, you know, and I think this is where that analogy comes back, right? Because when we're talking about an AI lawyer, it's important that we're not actually talking about an AI lawyer, right?
Yeah.
What we're talking about is a series of very, very powerful tools that allow one lawyer to serve, you know, 100 people in a really cursory way, as opposed to 3 people in a really detailed way, right? Yeah. And I mean, that is powerful. Right. Like, don't get me wrong. And I think that's the thing that we often miss, right? I'm not saying, hey, oh, you know, we don't have an AI lawyer and that's bad. I'm saying, no, we don't have an AI lawyer in the way that we've been thought about it in the sci-fi world.
Yes.
What we have, I would argue, is actually something that's much more powerful, right?
Yeah.
Because you think, hey, you know, I've got some, you know, lawyer that sort of tries to replicate what a human lawyer does, but it does a crappy job, right? Because AI, you know, it doesn't matter how good it gets. If the job is mimicking a human, it's never going to be as good as a human. Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, whatever, call it 50% the quality, which would even be, you know, a very, very good machine. Right. It's not that useful compared to something that makes your one human, you know, 100 times more effective. right? And so that's why I think that access is just so much more powerful. And again, when you look at the robo advisors out there, when you look at the, you know, like AI powered accountants, right? When you look at the AI powered lawyers, right? I think there is that path to just radically increase access to these services that are cost prohibitive to folks today, right?
Let's talk about that bionic arm then. Where do you see that bionic arm being most effective in the next few years?
So I think that the cost is still very, very high. And I think getting a successful sort of implementation together, you know, a really high kind of, you know, industrial efficacy bionic arm for a use case, you know, it takes real effort, right? And, you know, to that point I said where people are going to need this basic understanding of AI, many organizations have embraced that, right? You definitely have started to see it, but still very, very early days, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is really, and I think that's going to remain true for at least the next 5 years, let's call it, right? The expense is going to be high. I mean, the ROI is still very, very high, right? I think we've recently gotten to the point where people can have success. People are having success. They're being very, very public about it. And suddenly people have realized, okay, there is actually a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And, you know, there probably wasn't, or, you know, that was a question 5 years ago, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But I still think, you know, you're going to look at, you know, larger enterprises adopting this more aggressively. I think that there's going to be a couple of smaller companies that are willing to say, this is going to be a key competency of ours and kind of forward invest, and they're going to win out. And I think there are going to be a lot of people that sort of wake up in 5 years and realize that they've missed the boat, right? That's how I kind of see things shaking out.
Yep. Being who I am and what I do, I have my own small business, worked for myself for a decade. I'm partial to those forms of AI that anybody can use, that I can log into Canva and do something cool that I wouldn't be able to do, or I can use Pixelmator Pro and boom, I can reconstruct an image, you know, in high quality that wasn't there before, other stuff like that. I assume that's growing significantly as well.
It's growing. I would say that if you look across at AI, it's probably by a significant margin sort of the slowest growing, right, and like least impactful area today, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think when I look at that space, I mean, the problem, just frankly, is that the technology is incredibly expensive to use and run, right? And the unit economics are really hard to work out. I mean, again, I mean, you mentioned GPT-3, right? You're talking millions of dollars in just compute power to train this thing a single time. Right. And you know, it just means that fundamentally folks are going to be a little bit more reticent to take these really big consumer risks. Again, I mean, there's, you know, Google and Facebook is, you know, very obvious exceptions to that. So there's going to be things breaking through. What I'm super excited about and Adobe, and actually some, I think a lot of the examples you used were actually in this domain, because I think this is actually going to be the big exception, is the connection with kind of creative software. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Adobe is in an awesome, awesome spot to kind of take advantage of this. Other companies, too. I mean, Canva, I'm sure, is certainly using this in pretty impactful ways. But, you know, we did DCGAN back in the day. And I just think that the stuff with neural style transfer as well, I mean, it's incredible. Right. And I think it's a perfect example of that sort of peanut butter and jelly, where I think 100% computer generated, like, give me static random noise or whatever, that's not very interesting, right? But, you know, where these things have worked their way into artist toolkits to give them new ways of generating art, I mean, you just see some beautiful, beautiful stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I know a college professor who has a generative art design program and shares some of that on social from time to time. Very, very cool stuff. Let's talk about jobs. That's always the worry. There's increased automation. We know that physical automation in manufacturing, which uses AI in a lot of cases, obviously, as well as increased automation in white collar or knowledge worker jobs. Are we going to decrease the number of available jobs for humans, or are we going to increase the amount of work that we can do?
Yeah. And you know, again, I'm in the second camp here, right? I think that the arc of history on this one is very, very clear, right? Is generally what you see with automation is an increase in the amount of work that you're able to do. I think what people also, you know, kind of assume, and it is actually turning out not to be the case, is that people often have this assumption that, you know, you use manufacturing as an example. And again, automation manufacturing is actually a lot harder than some of the more traditional software automation that we're seeing, right? And so I think that that's actually, so it's actually turned out such that a lot of the kind of, you know, lowest level jobs are some of the most difficult to go after. It kind of asks this question of what is it really that's special about human cognition in some ways, right? Yes. And actually where you see a lot of success is in helping sort of the higher, you know, sort of the lawyers and folks like that, you know, very high. Sorry, doing some construction above me, I suppose.
No worries. Don't worry. I can't hear it all.
Great.
Yeah. Awesome. I think that's great. I think that we covered pretty much everything here. I want to thank you for taking the time.
Thanks. I'm sorry about the sound and the video and whatnot, but hopefully it was still on the table.
I could not tell that there was anything else going on, so the audio is perfectly fine. So don't even worry about that. And I kind of find the image fading in and out a little bit artistic. Maybe it's, you know, the revenge of AI.
That's the generative art, right?
Excellent. Have a great day.
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, thanks for taking the time.